From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
The wooden toothpicks, the machine-made toothpicks, had a texture to them that some people just found pleasurable to chew on them. And very fashionable people would come out of good hotels, good restaurants, stand around on the steps after the meal and just enjoy this postprandial experience of chewing on a toothpick.
That's Duke University professor Henry Petrosky. I talked to him about this indispensable tool back in 2008 after he published a book called The Toothpick, Technology and Culture. This week, we're sharing some of my favorite conversations from the past decade, starting with this one. So how far back does toothpick use go?
Anthropologists believe it goes back about 2 million years.
Were pretty much all early toothpicks made out of wood, out of twigs?
It seems pretty good bet that people, as far back as we can imagine, did tear a branch off a tree and take a splinter out of it and use it.
I would imagine that in certain cultures and in certain times, when I think about ancient China or Japan, I think perhaps maybe toothpicks may have been made out of ivory or other objects and were sort of more precious. Is that the case?
Yes, that is the case. For those that could afford those things, it was common to carry around a personal toothpick.
And for people who didn't have the means, did they just whittle their own?
A lot of people did, that's right. Or they might use a lesser valued materials such as, say, iron, which would effectively be a nail.
Given that people whittled their own, how did the idea of a manufactured product succeed? I would imagine it had to be sold to people, that something that they would have to buy would have more value than something they could just make themselves.
Well, that's right. Back in the 19th century, a lot of things began to be made by machinery. It was really just the natural extension of the Industrial Revolution. And there was a fellow from the New England area named Charles Forster who was working in Brazil, and he noticed that the natives down there were carving toothpicks by hand. He also noticed that the natives had very white, very clean, decayless teeth. He thought, well, I think that I can make a fortune, literally, if I go back to New England and I begin to make toothpicks by machine, and sell them in such a way that I could undersell even these natives in Brazil. But it was not as easy to do as he first thought. He had to acquire the patent rights to machines that could make toothpicks, and he then had to develop the machinery and figure out exactly what wood was best for toothpicks. That took him close to about 10 years. When he finally was able to produce toothpicks in such vast quantities, he found that, well, now he had to sell them to people, and not only literally sell them, but also in the sense of marketing them.
Before we get into the marketing, I'm just fascinated by the idea of making a toothpick. My mind tends to go to a cartoon place where you have a tree and all of a sudden the tree is on a lathe and what's left of the tree is this one little toothpick.
Well, the beginning is actually correct. It does start as a tree. In fact, white birch, then the bark was taken off the tree and then it was literally put on a lathe. And it was sort of peeled. A veneer was peeled from around it, and sometimes as long as 100 feet. And then that was fed into a machine that literally chopped off toothpicks the way we might cut cookies out of cookie dough.
So let's talk about how he marketed this old tool in a new way, because he was pretty ingenious.
Right. Well, you remember in the mid-19th century, just about everybody either had a personal toothpick that they carried around with them, ivory, brass, bronze, whatever, gold even, and silver. So Forster had to figure out a way to break the habits of people and get them accustomed to buying toothpicks that they would then dispose of. What he did is he hired students from Harvard to eat in a restaurant in Boston. After they enjoyed their meal, they would call for the manager and ask where his wooden toothpicks were. When the manager said, well, I don't know what you're talking about, they essentially stomped out of the restaurant and say, we'll never come to this establishment again because you don't provide toothpicks for your guests after the meal. Well, of course, the next day, Charles Forster shows up peddling precisely these things that the students had demanded. Naturally, the restaurant manager can't refuse to buy some and distribute to his customers.
Now, what about this custom of walking around with your walking stick and your top hat and having a toothpick in your mouth that you just sort of kept there and moved from side to side and chewed on. Was that an affectation that was marketed as well, or did that just happen naturally?
That seems to have happened naturally. This happened in the 1870s and 1880s, and these dandies who often had a cane with them came to be known as the Crutch and Toothpick Brigade. They they would walk down the street chewing their toothpicks.
Henry Petrosky is a professor at Duke and the author of nearly two dozen books. One of them is called The Toothpick, Technology and Culture. We first aired that conversation in 2008. Next in this Greatest Hits show, we talk Mormon food, from funeral potatoes to Jell-O salad. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
Mormon recipes are not so different from typical Middle Western recipes. You'll see Mormons making jokes about their own food that sound just like the jokes Methodists make about their food, or Presbyterians or Episcopalians joking about Jell-O salads, for instance, or typical casseroles brought to potluck dinners.
That's Kate Holbrook. She's a historian for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and she's done extensive research into the role food plays in the Mormon community. We first aired this interview 6 years ago. In this process of you learning about Mormon women in the kitchen, what did you find out? Are food and cooking an important part of the society, or are they always in the background?
They're an important part of the society. The congregation is called a ward, and there are a lot of ward cookbooks. I study particularly the 20th century, and they used to have lessons once a month called homemaking lessons, where people would gather to learn how to cook or how to sew something or how to do something in the home. But the letters from the leaders of the Relief Society that went from Salt Lake City headquarters out to the individual wards, they emphasized that food served at those meetings should be nutritious. It should be economical. It should be easy to prepare, so that it was providing a model for the women who attended the meetings about how to prepare that kind of food at their home. So they didn't want women just serving desserts at these meetings. They wanted food to be nutritious, easy to prepare, and economical.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was looking at a recipe for funeral potatoes.
Uh-huh.
Could you take us through the ingredients?
Yeah, typically funeral potatoes have some kind of canned soup, cream of chicken soup or cream of mushroom soup. There are a few stalwarts who will grate their own potatoes, but usually it's an industrialized form of potatoes, frozen hash browns. They have sour cream in them. They have cheese in them. And then they normally have crushed cornflakes on top. The popularity of funeral potatoes, particularly to be served at funerals, is based on the fact that these travel well. They can be prepared ahead of time. These tend to be things that Mormon women would have in their pantries. They have extensive pantries. So you could call somebody and say, so-and-so just died. In 2 days, we need you to bring funeral potatoes to serve the guests at the funeral. And the woman would already have the things that she needed to be able to throw that dish together.
Let's talk about these extensive pantries for a minute. I understand that the church advocates at least 3 months worth of food stored. Why is this?
A few reasons. In the 1930s, the church was concerned about how many Utahns were on national welfare during the Depression. They were worried that government sources of funding would run out and that people would be left really in trouble. So they started their own welfare program. The welfare was based on feeding the poor, but it also had a strong component of teaching self-sufficiency. They really taught people to store their own food so that in a time of need, they would have resources. They taught them how to save money, not spend more than they should. They teach that you shouldn't go into debt unless it's for a house or education. People would often use industrialized food products as a part of their food pantries. Initially, you were to store 2 years' worth of food, and then they took it down in the last couple of decades. Keeping a garden was another important part of this. And so people would grow their own food, and then they would bottle the food or freeze it or dry it. So that was part of their food storage.
Is there an ethical component of food choices?
There is. A few years after Joseph Smith founded the Mormon Church, he received a revelation called the Word of Wisdom. And that outlines something that would sound familiar to, you know, somebody like Michael Pollan or Barbara Kingsolver. It says, eat very little meat, eat food in season, feed animals properly according to what they should be fed. It's a little bit puzzling why some of those things are out there when this revelation was received in the 1830s, before food was really industrialized, before eating out of season was a possibility. But now it has strong, powerful implications. People tend to look at the aspects of the Word of Wisdom that forbid coffee and alcohol and focus on those instead of the aspects that have more in common with today's locavores, like the eating in season and the eating of little meat.
Now, part of your study has been to compare the cultural significance of food in Mormonism with that of the Nation of Islam, which seems like they wouldn't have very much in common.
Right. That's part of why I chose to compare the two groups. Both groups are considered new religious movements, and both have some aspects that are quintessentially American, but they're geographically and racially quite distinct groups. So I find it very interesting that both emphasize growing your own food, having some land, food storage for times of want. Both emphasize health a great deal. That's popular now, and it's been popular all through the 20th century, but there's a lot of rhetoric about health and eating properly and in order to honor the body that God has given you.
And in the case of the Mormons, this is for the hereafter.
It's for now and the hereafter. Mormon theology is very rooted in a notion that people are supposed to be happy and that God wants them to be happy, and God gives them rules so that they can be happy now and happy during the hereafter. The Nation of Islam doesn't believe in life after death, or didn't, at least in the time of Elijah Muhammad. So they wanted to maximize their lives now, wanted to be happy now, wanted to be economically well off now. Health was particularly important to them because it was related to longevity. And they believed that if they ate correctly, which included just eating one meal per day, that they would be able to live long, long lives, like hundreds of years even.
What about the role of fasting, of depriving oneself of food in both religions?
So for the Nation of Islam, that was a lot about health. And most of the language about it is health. And Elijah Muhammad taught that if you allowed yourself 22 hours to digest your food, then the food would no longer harm the body. But if you were constantly feeding the body, then there were harmful particles that wouldn't have the chance to be fully digested and expelled from the body. So he taught that there were even some diseases, some problems with high blood sugar that could be controlled if you would only eat one meal per day. With the Mormons, there are two main reasons they fast. One is about spiritual power. Depriving the body of food puts you more in touch with spiritual matters. It also shows God your humility and the depth of your desire. So you're more likely to get answers for prayers if you're fasting. But the other interesting thing about Mormon fasting, which is pretty unique to them, is that even when Joseph Smith, from the very beginning, when he was teaching people to fast, he said that the reason they should fast is so they could give the food that they did not eat to people who had no food. So it was an effort directly related to alleviating poverty. And so Mormons, they skip two meals during the first Sunday of each month. And sometimes if they want, they might fast at some additional period. But what they're supposed to do is fast during the first Sunday of the month. And then in a generous way, calculate how much money they may have spent on the meals that they skipped. And then they put that into a general fund for the poor.
Wow. We talked a little bit about the dish funeral potatoes. Aside from that, what are some of the most common Mormon dishes in the early days of the church and now?
Well, in the early days of the church, Mormons ate what you would see anybody in the areas they were in eating. So, you know, when they were in Missouri, they would eat the way other Missourians ate. That's a little less interesting. In the middle 20th century, they also looked a lot like, especially people in the middle of the country, ate with a lot of industrialized food products and a lot of casseroles. You know, a leaf of lettuce with a little jello on top of it is a salad side dish. What does set Mormon food apart a little bit is the emphasis on rotating food storage, because if you have all of this wheat and all of these canned goods stored up, wheat was a big deal, then you need to be able to use them or else they spoil and you don't want waste. Whereas a regular cookbook from Ohio would have a recipe for zucchini bread that had called for all-purpose flour, the Mormon version of zucchini bread was more likely to have some whole wheat flour, and they were trying to throw whole wheat flour in wherever they could, or non-fat milk. That was a part of food storage because it has a longer shelf life. And so whereas other bread recipes would call for fresh milk, Mormon bread recipes would be more likely to call for the dehydrated milk or for canned evaporated milk.
Kate Holbrook is a historian for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Now we're going to hop out of the Wayback Machine, come back to the present, and see what Laura Avery's shopping for this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
I'm happy to be visiting with Noelle Carter, who is the test kitchen director for the Los Angeles Times. She writes about seasonal produce. She publishes the Culinary SOS for those hard-to-find beloved recipes. And Noelle, you're here today. You're going to tell us a little bit more about the test kitchen and also tell us about the taste.
Well, it's this weekend, and it's our 8th annual taste, and it's bigger and better than ever. I'm hosting one of the events, the Sunday Block Party, with Sherry Yard. You know her from Spago, and now she's at Tuck Room Tavern. And it's just going to be a fun event.
And what exactly are you two crazy ladies going to be doing?
Oh, gosh, we've got a bunch of things going on. We're going to be chatting about brunch. Sherry's doing a demo. And then I'm going to be watching over the ultimate biscuit demo. If you want to know how to make good biscuits, LA has a great biscuit scene. And we've got David Lefebvre and Jason Fullalove coming in, and they're going to show, like, tips and tricks for making awesome biscuits.
So biscuits, you need basically a jar to cut little circles, right?
And you do. But, you know, there are a few, like, really good hints, like keep your ingredients cold. I use a pastry cutter. My mom, she was a big baker growing up, and I learned a lot of what I know from her. And, you know, you cut in those ingredients, so when the butter melts, it creates the steam, so you've got all these flaky layers. But I know David and Jason are going to have some great tips to share.
Will they be baking biscuits for us to taste?
They will be. We will have samples with all the demos this year, which will be awesome.
That sounds amazing. And then what else, like, is something that's new that we should be kind of looking for?
You know, it's funny, walking around the markets, and I see you every week. It's so good to see you. We've got figs are like really, really big right now. And it's figs have such a small season, and they're such a delicate fruit, a flower actually. And there are like several hundred kinds of figs out there. And, you know, we've got several beautiful ones out here beyond just the Mission figs or the Turkey figs. There are a bunch of great figs. I love making a jam with them, and jam goes really well with biscuits. And, you know, it's just, it's that time of year, and it's a perfect component.
Right. And probably one of the best ways to preserve the seasonal magic of this market is, like you said, Noelle, to make the jam with, for example, figs.
You know, it's funny. With so much of the great produce, it's like you put everything in a pot with some sugar, maybe some pectin, and you cook it down. You might flavor it with a thing or two. One of my favorite things to do with figs is do a little bit more of a savory take on it, and I do a fresh fig salsa, which is super simple to make. It's a little olive oil. You saute an onion until it's nice and soft. Add maybe a half pound of figs chopped up, and you just cook them down for a few minutes until they start to break down and they're getting like all nice and gooey. And then I like to add some white wine and a little chicken stock, and I cook that down until you get that perfect jammy consistency. Toss in some more figs, even out the consistency a little with a little extra chicken stock if you like, and it's perfect on a freshly baked biscuit with a little bit of butter, some really nice butter. Perfect snack.
Right. And tell us a little more now about the test kitchen. What goes on in there?
Oh, gosh. Every single recipe that runs in the food section is tested and frequently retested until we get it right, because we want to make sure that the recipes work before they run in the section, which I think we're one of just a handful of newspapers and publications that still actually have a test kitchen.
So who gets to come into the test kitchen? You are the head test kitchen tester.
I'm the head person. I'm the one that tests most of the recipes, mm-hmm. but we have people from the sections, neighboring sections that come in sometimes. We've got travel and books that are nearby us, and they offer their palates to sample the dishes as we're testing them. We just did a big brownie story. And we tested about a dozen different kinds of brownies. And so we had people from all over the paper coming in. It was work related, trying all these brownies.
Somebody's got to do it.
It's a tough job.
Right. All right. Well, this is exciting. So the taste is Saturday and Sunday?
It's September 1st through 3rd, Friday night through Sunday, and five events. I'm going to be hosting the one tomorrow morning on Sunday. Come on down. It's at the Paramount Backlot, and you're going to have a great time.
Okay, Biscuits Sunday morning. It sounds like a date.
Good. So I'll see you there.
That was Noelle Carter. She is the test kitchen director for the LA Times. She also writes a lot of the columns you'll see, the Culinary SOS, the Seasonal Market Report on what produce is in season, and urging us all to head on over to Paramount Backlot and taste LA. I'm talking now with farmer Stephen Murray from Murray Family Farm up in the Bakersfield, Arvin area. And the Murrays bring in the earliest cherries in California. They have a beautifully eclectic, wonderful farm and several varieties of figs as well. Tell us how many varieties of figs you grow.
Well, it's kind of actually a little bit hard to say because I've collected a lot of varieties at sign exchanges across California. So I think I have about 15 or so.
15 varieties. And of those, how many can you bring to market on a regular basis?
So the varieties that I bring regularly, I have Violette de Bordeaux, which I have one customer that they buy most of them. The other one is the White Cadotta, which was originally cultivated in southern Italy. We have Black Mission, which is the ancient variety from California from the Mission time period, and Brown Turkey. We also grow some that I was calling experimental figs, which are basically the ones where I lost the tags. And we have one that is a purple striped fig, which every once in a while I'll have a few of those. But like today, they sold out by about 850.
So on the figs, there are so many different varieties, and figs bear twice a year. Tell us about their crazy season.
Figs are very different from other plants in how they reproduce. So a lot of figs are wasp obligate. So there's some figs that if they don't have a wasp, then they don't produce an edible fruit. Then there's also types of figs that are the San Pedro type that they have one crop a year. And then there's figs that are the common type, which has two crops a year. The first crop is called the Breva crop, which is earlier in the summer, and it's on last year's wood. Then there's the second crop, which is called the main crop, which grows on new growth from during that season.
So we're in the late harvest now.
Yes, we are.
Okay, and how long will this go on?
So for us, we're probably going to have figs for another, at least quantities for another maybe 2 or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many of the ones you're bringing are the ones that have to be, whatever, fertilized by a wasp?
So I have one variety at the I-5 that is a wasp obligate. There was a tree in my backyard that was from seed that for 5 years in a row, all the figs were just, you open them and they're like a puffball of dry air stuff. Mm-hmm. But we finally had the wasp has arrived in our area. So now all of our fig trees are wasp pollinated. And that variety went from being a dry, dehiscent, ball of terribleness to a sweet, delicious, lush fig.
And the wasps just somehow find the figs? You don't bring in or import the wasps or buy pollinators?
The wasp made it there by themselves.
When I buy a basket of figs, I want them all to be soft, right?
Yeah.
Because after they've been picked and they're in the basket, they're not going to get any softer or better once they're off the tree.
Yeah, figs don't really change much after they're picked. So figs are not, they will a little bit. So figs will get a little bit softer, but it's not going to be like an avocado.
So when I go through a basket of figs, I'm kind of like trying to pinch them all to make sure that they're all soft.
That's how I would do it, yeah.
Is that the ideal?
Yeah. The way I like figs, I like them to be real jammy. I like softer figs, and I like really sweet stuff.
Some of them, literally, there'd be a green outside or a white outside, and you bite in, and it's like a big blob of strawberry jam. That's the best.
That's what I like.
Yeah. Okay.
And we also have the White Cadotas are famous because they all have a drop of honey on the bottom, too.
Mm-hmm.
I have a restaurant that's been asking me if I could go out and collect the honey and process it for him so that he could buy it. It tastes good, but I don't think the labor on that would really pencil out.
Right. Well, I mean, it's all the stages of the fig, life cycle are fascinating. And it's so nice to see so many varieties here at the market now. And we can taste new kinds of figs and make the jam that Noelle was talking about. So thank you for growing them.
Sure.
And we enjoy them.
Yeah, and we're planting even more varieties. Next year, I should have some of the tiger stripe fig.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really nice type. And I'm going to be propagating more of my purple striped fig, which was created by a breeder in the Lost Hills area. So we're the only ones that have that variety.
Okay, great. Well, it's always good to go to your stand. You do have quite an eclectic variety of things to look at. So thanks for everything you do.
Thank you very much, Laura.
That was Stephen Murray Jr. of Murray Family Farms. And they grow up in Bakersfield and bring just such a great variety of items to the farmer's market. They come to Wednesday Santa Monica, Virginia Avenue Park Santa Monica, Sunday Santa Monica.
Sunday Santa Monica. Yeah. And very soon in October, we're going to have a massive October festival with lots of awesome activities.
In Bakersfield, so go check it out. Thank you, Stephen. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
In a minute, we return to Oldies but Goodies from the Good Food Archive. This segment covers a deadly but very sticky flood. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
On January 15, 1919, 2.3 million gallons of molasses swept through Boston's North End when a large storage tank collapsed.
That's Steve Puglio. The former newspaper reporter wrote a bestseller about the Great Boston Molasses Flood of 1919. It's called Dark Tide. I talked to him about it back in 2010.
Killed 21 people, injured 150, many, many very seriously, and caused enormous property damage in Boston's North End, and really spawned one of the largest civil action lawsuits in Massachusetts history to this day.
Why was there such a huge vat of molasses there anyway? What was the role of molasses in 1919?
Sure. Molasses was a federally protected industry in 1919 for the very reason that it was distilled into industrial alcohol and then further processed and used in the munitions production process for the First World War. It was used to create nitroglycerin, TNT, high explosives, and the company that owned the tank, United States Industrial Alcohol, a private company with United States in the name, had as some of its largest customers the French and British governments before the U.S. entered the war, some of the larger munitions producers in the United States, and then once the U.S. enters the war in 1917, the U.S. government becomes a large customer. And so the molasses tank was essentially a holding tank for the raw molasses, which was then transported about a mile away to a distilling plant where it was put into this process.
And this molasses tank was not inside a building. It was outside the building, correct?
That is correct. A freestanding tank, 200 feet from the shoreline. And so the big molasses steamers that came up from Cuba and Puerto Rico and the West Indies, and they held 700,000, 800,000 gallons worth of molasses in their holds, could offload their product into this tank. And then from there, the molasses was offloaded into rail cars. Maybe we would think of them as oil cars today, and then transported to the distilling site. Picture a large five-story steel tank held together with thousands of rivets in the midst of an extremely congested residential and commercial neighborhood.
The tank leaked from the first day it was installed, so much so that it was actually painted a color so that the leaks wouldn't show so much.
Yeah, U.S. industrial alcohol was under tremendous pressure to meet these quotas, and the tank was rushed to completion, shoddily completed, and did leak from day one, really long 50-foot leaks that would stream down the side of the tank, so much so that children used to come and scoop up molasses that had pooled around the bottom of the tank. And yes, one of the responses by the company was to paint the tank from a steel gray color to a brownish-red color, the color of molasses. And there was lots of talk in the court testimony that followed how that sort of camouflaged the leaks, though not totally for sure.
Paint us a picture of what happened when it burst. Was it like a tsunami? I mean, how tall was the wave of this thick substance coming down the street?
Sure. This was almost literally like a small tidal wave. If you could picture, this tank disgorged its contents of molasses and it came out high and hard, 35 feet high at the outset, about 35 miles per hour to start. It levels off at about 20 feet high and 160 feet wide. And it quite literally scours the Boston waterfront in the North End neighborhood, just as a wave would do. It picks up people, it picks up domestic animals, it picks up beer and produce, everything that was delivered to the Boston docks for shipping during this early part of the 20th century. And it destroys buildings, it turned the buildings in the area into kindling. There were stables nearby where municipal horses were kept, scooped up those horses, scooped up the stables. 20 horses were killed in the Great Boston Molasses Flood, in addition to 21 people. So if you can think of it just obliterating this Boston waterfront area, much as a tidal wave would do, as the molasses wave scoured the waterfront.
So then it finally stops flowing, and it's there, this pool, this sea of molasses. What a mess. How did they clean it up?
That evening, the cleanup began, and firefighters did try to hook up their hoses to municipal hydrants, and it didn't do much good because by then the molasses had begun to congeal and harden. It doesn't totally harden, but it does begin to congeal. Finally, one enterprising firefighter had the idea that maybe salt water, the brine from the salt water, would begin to cut the molasses, and that's exactly what they did. They pumped millions of gallons of water out of Boston Harbor and began that process of washing the molasses away. Most of it was washed into the harbor. The harbor was stained brown for months afterwards. And the molasses that had filled the cellars in the basements of the houses nearby up to the first floor, that was pumped out with really crude hydraulic pumps of the day. But most of the molasses cleanup began by washing it with salt water back into Boston Harbor.
Wow. Is it true that on a hot day, people in that neighborhood still smell molasses?
One of the great folklores of the flood is that, but it isn't true. You still can't smell it. You could smell it for years afterwards. Some of the people who used to work for companies like Boston Gas and the electric companies in Boston, who used to venture into those basements to read meters in the late 1950s and early 1960s, reported smelling molasses in those walls, essentially, many, many years afterwards. But no, you can't smell it in the air anymore. I've been down there on hot days many, many times. But it is one of the great bits of folklore, I think, that surfaced about the flood.
Steve Puglio's book is about the Great Boston Molasses Flood of 1919. It's called Dark Tide. Being a total food nerd who's also into languages means that I'm fascinated with the words we use to describe our food. When I learned linguist Dan Jurofsky had written a book called The Language of Food 4 years ago, I jumped at the chance to talk with him. Here's our conversation from 2014. I'd love to start with the research that you did on menu language. It's pretty revealing, but also kind of funny and sad, too. Can you contrast the language of really high-end menus today and more middle-brow places?
Yes, there's a number of really fun differences. This is research my colleagues at Carnegie Mellon and at Stanford and I did. And so we looked at about 6,500 menus online, and we did find a lot of differences between your fancy high-priced menus and your cheaper menus. So just to give one little example, the cheaper the restaurant, the more the word you is mentioned, your way or any way you like them or your choice. Whereas the more expensive the restaurant, the more it's about the chef. You get phrases like chef's choice or chef's selection. It's as if the cheaper restaurants, the menus are really appealing to you, the diner. And in the expensive restaurants, you know, it's really more like theater. You're going there to see what the chef is going to offer you, and they make that clear in the menu.
What about the descriptive language of menu items?
Also very different. So your expensive restaurants, very terse. They might have fancy, long words like persillade or chiffonade, but there are not very many of them. You know, a dish will have a name and maybe a few listed ingredients with commas. Where we see a lot of vocabulary is, in fact, in the middle-priced restaurants, your Cheesecake Factories or your California Pizza Kitchens. That's where you see all these beautiful adjectives: fresh, rich, mild, crispy, tender, golden brown. It's as if the expensive restaurants, they don't tell you your food is crisp. You're supposed to assume the food is crisp. The middle-priced restaurants, they're kind of protesting too much. They need to convince you the food is crispy. The fact that they say crispy tells us, the readers, that in fact, they think you might not believe it's crispy, and they have to do some work to convince you.
I'm never going to look at a menu the same way again.
No, it's so interesting. And the word delicious, so if you see delicious or tasty or scrumptious, that's the really cheapest menus. That's your cheapest small diners. They're not going to talk a lot about crispy and golden brown and tender, but they're just going to use this vague positive word like delicious. You can't sue somebody if your food's not delicious.
One of my favorite parts of your book is how you will trace certain dishes or ingredients from one part of the world to another through language. The food that most intrigued me was the pickled fish, which starts in the Middle East.
That's a great story. Put yourself in 6th century Persia. And in fact, the story goes back even older, but we'll start there. So this is Sasanid Persian Empire. The Shah, Khosrow, he had a favorite dish. And this dish was called sikbaj, and sik is still the modern Farsi word for vinegar. So sikbaj was a kind of vinegary stew. It was like a sweet and sour stew. It had beef, it had vinegar, it had all these spices, rue and parsley and cilantro, it had sugar. There's all these great stories about the Shah and his favorite dish and the different chefs. You know, he had all the chefs into a competition about who could cook the best dish, and of course they all picked his favorite dish to cook. Then the next empire, the Islamic Abbasid Caliphate, it's established in Baghdad. They built this beautiful new city, Baghdad, the City of Peace, in an area that was formerly Persian-speaking. So they hired all these Persian-speaking chefs. And so sikbaj again becomes the favorite court dish. And now it begins to spread with the Muslim empire around the Muslim world. So let's say by the 10th century, you can see it's mentioned as a fish dish. So now not just a vinegar and beef dish, it's a vinegar and fish dish, often with onions. And the dish, now it moves to Christian Europe. And of course, in those days, the medieval period, there are lots of fast days for Christians in Europe. Wednesdays and Fridays are meatless days, no meat, no dairy, and so there's lots of fish in the cookbooks.
And how has the name changed, or what are the names?
Yeah, so the names move with the dish. So we first see evidence in the south, in Italy, as areas that are under Moorish control or that neighbor on Muslim areas. So you see a name called scabeche or scabeccio, and then as it moves north, the word changes as the food changes. So, for example, this fried fish served cold, the broth of the fried fish is now a kind of jelly, and this cold fish jelly is called al-sikbaj, the sikbaj in Arabic, and that gets barred into Latin as al-sikbikium, and then it turns into aspic in French. So that's the origin of our meat jelly, aspic. And then the word moves again west through Europe, gets to Catalonia and Spain, and it's called now escabeche, a modern dish you still have of a fried cold dish. It's usually fish, but it can be vegetables now, soaked in vinegar and onions. And then the food leaves the Iberian Peninsula in a bunch of fabulous ways. Pizarro and his Spanish soldiers, they go to Peru, and they bring a version that uses sour orange juice instead of vinegar, and they find the local Moche Indians are eating a raw fish and chili dish, and the two dishes somehow merge, and that gets called ceviche. And then the Portuguese, the Jesuits, go to Japan to establish missions there, and they bring Portuguese cookbooks, and we have evidence for early Portuguese cookbooks in Japan that talk about a fried dish called tempura. And sure enough, the Japanese fried fish and fried vegetables dish in which you're battered and deep fried borrows this Portuguese word. Tempura comes from the Portuguese word just for seasoning. Again, at the same time, it's amazing. All this is happening at the same time. The Jews are kicked out of Spain and Portugal, and they bring a version of this sikbaj dish to England. And the version they bring, you bread the fish, you fry it, and you eat it cold with vinegar. And then potatoes fried in drippings arrive, and the two dishes are combined, and fish and chips is invented.
So fantastic. Fish and chips, which is still served with malt vinegar as a condiment.
Absolutely. And it's the remnants of how the king of Persia liked to eat his meat stew in the 6th century. And in fact, it goes older. The oldest cookbook we have is from about 1700 BC. It's in Akkadian, the language of ancient Mesopotamia. And there are recipes for stews with vinegar and the same kind of herbs that we see with sikbaj, rue and so on, that suggest that really this dish has been cooked in the Mediterranean for 4,000 years, and we're still eating all of its descendants, who are all cousins of each other.
Dan Jurofsky's book, The Language of Food, was published in 2014.
Order in 2 sandwiches and a quarter white.
Yes, chef.
Order in the wings and the waffles.
Yes, chef.
Thank you, chef.
That's the sound of the kitchen at Hal and Ray's at Far East Plaza in Chinatown. Silver Lake's own Johnny Raisone opened the restaurant with his wife Amanda Chapman last year. Jonathan Gold says it is the place to go for Nashville-style hot chicken in L.A.
There's a Nashville tradition started in a place called Prince's about 50 years ago of hot chicken. And the legend is that some relative of the current owner had a girlfriend who was tired of his messing around, so she made him a batch of fried chicken with enough cayenne pepper in it to essentially kill or stun.
But he liked it.
He liked it a lot.
A backfire to emotional hostagery, but benefit for us.
Whereas the chicken follows a lot of the principles of really good fried chicken, the extreme heat is the point of it. And if you get it at the level which they call howling hot, it becomes a decision that will take over your next 2 days.
So we're not allowed to have it, like, not quite howling hot?
Oh, sure you can. I mean, there's all kinds of levels, and I don't think I will ever order it howling hot again. But you should probably have at least one piece that way to see what they do. You know, medium is extremely hot. Mild is as hot as, say, other decent hot chicken places will have it. And then they have, they call it country style or something, but it has no heat in it at all. Anyway, we're here with the howling hot chicken. You get it, and it's straight out of the fryer when you get it. You burn your fingers when you're trying to tear it in half. The seasoning, which is this vivid scarlet, will work its way under your fingernails and all over your hands. You put it in your mouth. You try to get as much of the crunchy part as you can. And it's just a good piece of chicken, you know, that's salt and it's crunch and it's garlic. And there's sort of that musky, musty, dried pepper taste. And it's not as bad as you think it is. 2 seconds later, it takes over. And it's like you've been punched in the face. It's like Oscar De La Hoya there has just punched you.
It's funny. The last time I was at the Far East Plaza, I was there to eat chago.
Yeah.
And so I was just watching everybody else mop their faces with copious amounts of napkins.
Well, here's the thing. You've got this stuff under your fingernails, and so the sweat just erupts from your body, but especially from your face and your head. And so it's a hot day, and you're outside, and you unconsciously use the back of your hand to wipe the sweat off. And then you realize you've got a situation there, too, because it feels as if you've been lying on the beach for 3 hours without sunscreen.
I noticed when I was watching people eat this that the sandwich looked mighty good, too.
The sandwich is really good. You can get the sandwich that hot, too, if you like. It is, I don't know, it's a chicken sandwich. There's a bun, sort of like a soft bun. There's lettuce. There's something called comeback sauce, which is big in Mississippi, which is basically somewhere between Thousand Island dressing and remoulade. And there's a giant slab of chicken, like almost a whole breast. You can also get that howling hot, if you like. It's delicious. You can get a pile of wings that you can put comeback sauce over and have your chicken that way. What makes this chicken hot isn't just the cayenne. He also uses extracts of habanero, some ghost pepper in there. There's some red savina, which used to be the hottest pepper in the world before the Trinidad Scorpion took over that prize.
This pepper thing is kind of insane. And I know this is completely gratuitous, but do they have anything for dessert?
They have chocolate chip cookies, but you're in this mall, so you may well want to, after your first 3 bites of chicken, turn tail and run directly into the scoops.
For ice cream.
For ice cream afterwards. What flavor would you like to taste? I don't care. What kind of ice cream would you like? Now. And there's also, of course, Endorphin Coffee, which is one of my favorite coffee stands in the city, which is right there.
And perfectly named.
Perfectly named. Where they make a pandan spiced iced latte that's absolutely perfect for super spicy food.
Oh, that's great. And you have plenty of time in that line to go get it.
You have time for seconds and thirds. I'd go to this place more often, but the last time I was in this line, it was 2.5 hours. And as much as I love this place, I'm not sure that I'm up to that every week. And it's sort of like waiting in one of those endless lines at Knott's Berry Farm and seeing people just stagger completely drained of blood off one of those roller coasters that have turned you upside down 412 times.
If you'd like to skip those lines, Jonathan's got one more fried chicken suggestion for you.
Gus's Fried Chicken.
Who's running this fried chicken joint?
Gus's is a chain. The first branch was in a small town in Tennessee. It's famous in Memphis, and it's in about, I don't know, 16, 20 other cities in the country, I think. And this is its first, you know, branch on the West Coast. People haven't really decided on the exact name of this neighborhood. Crenshaw District, Arlington Heights, Mid-City.
I found it really interesting that they chose that neighborhood, because usually when chains come in from the outside, they pick somewhere like downtown L.A. or Santa Monica.
I love the neighborhood they're in. I mean, there's a couple of places that I like to go to right around there. I mean, the wonderful Korean pork barbecue / pork neck soup place, Hamji Park, is right down the block. And the wonderful Guatemalan cevicheria, La Cevicheria, is very close. But it's not what you call a restaurant neighborhood exactly. I'm stoked. It's in like a sort of a retrofitted corner place. I think it was a Korean bar before that, maybe recording studio sometime in its distant past.
Yeah, part of me feels like it was either originally maybe a post office or a bank. It's a really beautiful old building. So let's talk about the food.
Well, the food is fried chicken, basically. Not only basically, I mean, that's the only protein on the menu. It's hot chicken, they call it, but it's nothing like the incredible heat of the Nashville-style chicken.
It's not punitive.
No. It's like you put a little bit of hot sauce in there somewhere. When it first comes out of the fryer, it's magnificent. It's really crunchy. It's sort of a burnished red gold. The pieces are bigger than they are small, and the heat just creeps up on you in a way that's really pleasant. Unlike the Nashville style at places like Howling Rays or Nickel Diner, it becomes noticeably less crunchy over about 10 minutes.
So is it the kind that if you don't attack it right away, you end up with sort of the flabby skin and not so exciting breading?
It's better than that. I mean, it has integrity, but you're definitely missing part of its glory. It's not great as next day picnic chicken.
What about take home chicken?
It will probably last long enough till you get home. I think they do a huge part of their business as takeout, but it's much better if you eat it there. That's a lot of the deep frying effect anyway, right? It's like donuts. Even Winchell's is incredibly good if you get it right out of the fryer.
It's true. Are you eating half chickens, parts, a sandwich, or all of the above?
I personally tend to order specials. So you can get like a dozen wings, or you can get 8 or 16 pieces of dark meat, and you have a whole table full of people around, and you order all the sides. I think they sell mostly in the form of plates, which will be, you know, 2 or 3 pieces that you get to choose, plus baked beans and slaw and white bread. There's always white bread involved.
Always.
And you can get it a lot of other ways. Let's say you order an 8-piece dark, which is, I think, a strong move. It comes out on a big platter. There are 3 pieces of white bread that, let's face it, nobody's going to touch, but it has to be there. It's part of the architectural form of the Southern chicken plate.
So if you want to make white bread tacos.
You could make white bread tacos. The baked beans are standard. The seasoned fries are actually pretty good. There's a really nice gooey mac and cheese. It's not the kind that somebody has spent a long time working on the bechamel for. It's like
a stovetop.
Yeah, it's your grandma's mac and cheese if your grandma made good mac and cheese, and really sort of meaty, porky greens with that sort of like little bit of collard stank. I like that little bit of collard stank.
Yeah, good greens are very important.
That's kind of it. You might want to start with an appetizer.
Why?
That's true. Why? Except that...
Are there appetizers?
Sort of. There's the best fried pickles I've ever had. And I actually would claim to have a certain amount of expertise in the fried pickle department. I've been to the famous fried pickle places in the South.
They're actually really, really good.
Every place I've ever had them before, they do the pickle chips and they bread and they fry. Here, they cut them into spears.
Ooh, that's very nice.
You get the meatiness of it. It preserves the sort of...
pickle integrity?
The pickle integrity, that the garlic flavor comes through. They're coated really nicely with the batter. It doesn't slip off. Almost everywhere you get fried pickles, you have one bite and then you're left with a really hot pickle and sort of an empty checker-shaped pickle casing. Made out of batter. They have integrity here. The fried green tomatoes are really good too, probably in the same way and for the same way.
Wow.
And then you're done and you get a piece of chess pie if you have room for it, or probably even if you don't, because chess pie is undeniable good thing.
I think this might be one of these instances in which people are listening and they are turning their cars.
Well, it's the chess pie.
Towards the sound of the frying. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Evan. By the way, if they ask if you want your chess pie heated, say no.
No.
Because the heating, it gives it a nice cloud-like consistency, but it just destroys the crust.
Spoken by a man who knows.
We do talk about pie around here, don't we?
That's Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, talking about Howlin' Ray's in Chinatown and Gus's Fried Chicken in what I'm going to call Mid-City. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. We close out the show with one more blast from the past. This time, we're talking about a cocktail of a very particular sort. Don't turn that dial.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. You might have followed a weird story a few weeks ago about a Yukon toe that went missing. In 2008, we learned about said toe in one of my favorite segments of all time. It's about a strange cocktail being served at the downtown hotel in Dawson City in the Yukon. Here's the bar's proprietor, Dick Van Norstrand. Okay, so when I hear the words sour toe cocktail, I imagine a toe in a drink.
That's exactly what it is. It's a petrified big toe.
It's a real toe.
A gnarly big toe.
A real toe. Okay. Are they preserved in some way or nuked within an inch of their lives so to make them palatable?
Well, they're initially preserved, of course, from the time that they're removed through a secretive process, which is basically petrifying them. When they're not in pure alcohol in a drink, then they're kept in pickling salts to keep them dried out.
What color are they?
Well, after they've been through quite a few drinks, they're fairly dark brown.
So they look extremely bruised? Or do they look like a log?
Yeah, they look like a bit of a log, but the most popular one that we have, it has a pretty big nail on it, and it's pretty gnarly, so you wouldn't be mistaking it for a piece of wood.
You just said the most popular one you have. So you have toes that people actually ask for?
We have two toes that we kind of circulate in and out of use so they don't end up getting soft at all.
Oh, gosh, a soft toe. That would be worse than a petrified toe.
You don't put the toe in your mouth. The toe goes into a straight shot of alcohol. You know,
what kind of alcohol?
One of the most popular things is Yukon Jack, which is basically only available up here. And it's a type of rum, but, you know, like vodka, gin, rye, scotch, anything. And then the toe, just the whole history of it is that the toe must touch your lips. You can drink the drink fast or you can drink it slow, but the toe must touch your lips and the captain must witness that.
And you are the captain.
I am the captain sometimes.
Sometimes you deputize others.
Well, in the summertime, I have other parts of the business to take care of.
Tell me the story behind the Sour Toe cocktail.
Captain Dick Stevenson was a riverboat captain on the Yukon River for many years. Later on in his career, he decided that he needed some place to be able to get away in the summertime and found out about a cabin upriver on the Yukon River. So he made arrangements to purchase it and took some buddies downriver to kind of clean the cabin up and get it ready to go so they could use it for that summer. And when they got into the cabin to start their work, one of the things they found was a quartz sealer jar with this petrified toe lying in the bottom of it. They had heard the story that the fellow that owned the cabin had suffered from frostbite one winter, and they had heard that he had maybe ended up cutting off his big toe to save himself from impending gangrene. And they grabbed the toe, and they proceeded to go to a local bar and sit down, and here they've got this toe, and there's a little bit of talk about how Alaska has these ice worms, and now you've got this toe, so why don't you just try that drink and throw that toe into it? And that's where it was born.
Oh, my goodness.
Ripley's has been up here to film it. It's pretty famous worldwide.
And has the health department?
We had it, I don't know, 8 or 10 years ago. One of the health department people from one of the other jurisdictions found out about it, and they decided that they would get officious, as those people sometimes like to do, and decided that they would challenge the whole thing, and that just didn't go anywhere. There's absolutely no issues with it at all.
Does a toe have a natural life as a cocktail accoutrement, or do you have to occasionally get a new toe, and if so, where does it come from?
Well, I can't imagine that they would outlive their natural life. The problem is that we've had macho dudes chew them up. We've had them mistakenly thrown out by bartenders that haven't been paying attention. So we have gone, over the years, we have gone through a few toes, and we're always looking in need of some backup toes. We've had people that are members of the club who have emailed us and said, you know, I've put you in my will so that when I die that you're going to be able to get my big toe. And so we are in some people's wills. We haven't gotten any of those yet, but we've just...
Perhaps this story will lead you to a new source of toes.
Well, that's what we need.
Now, I understand for those of us who might not want to go there, you have an option that's a suite.
Well, we took the toe down to Vancouver quite a few years ago and had a premium chocolate-making company down in Vancouver do a mold of the toe. And so we have dark Belgian chocolate toes.
Oh, I love that. That's like a foot fetishist's dream.
Yeah, there you go.
Dick, it has been very much fun talking with you. Thank you.
You too.
Sweet and sour. We first aired that unforgettable conversation with Dick Van Nostrand about the Sour Toe cocktail in 2008. Oh, and they found the toe. It's back at the bar. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, as always, you can listen to the show on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. And you can also download it wherever you get your podcasts. As always, so many thanks to the Good Food team, and here they are.
Laurel Garcia.
Joseph Stone.
Joel Stein.
Michelle Escobar.
And Ronnie Mickelson.
And I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.